This is Wake Up Call.
Another kind of daytime radio program.
On the Sports Map Radio Network.
All right. Let's do this.
Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, thanks for tuning in. It's hour number three. Coming up this hour at 40 past, we're going to talk to Ryan Ballinger. That's in 34 minutes. We're going to talk to him about the legacy of Greg Norman. ESPN's 30 for 30 will be tonight. And yeah, they'll be focusing a lot on the 1996 collapse at Augusta National, where he had a six-shot lead and ended up losing by five to Nick Faldo. But there's a lot more complexity to the career of Greg Norman, and especially given his association with the Saudi Golf League is causing so much trouble today. I thought it would be good to get an insight into this, what this documentary may reveal, and some insight into the career and off the course legacy of Greg Norman. You know, and there's a lot of people in sports that believe in something, right? They believe in a certain cause. They believe in something that they may be getting paid to promote, right? And there's no question that Greg Norman is getting paid to promote a new golf league. Right. Well, you know, other athletes may get paid to do certain things that are sort of different from the way business is run or the way business is. Right. Maybe an athlete is getting paid by a sports book and he wants to, you know, get gambling legalized in certain states, whatever it may be. But Greg Norman is not supporting the Saudi Golf League as an alternative to the PGA Tour as something that he just discovered because the paychecks were large. Greg Norman has always had odds with the way the PGA Tour runs things. He's always been a contrarian to the way the tour has run. Now, whether it was Dean Beaman, whether it was Tim Fincham, whether it's Jay Monahan, he's always sort of been a thorn in their side, or at least tried to be a thorn in their side to sort of change the way things are. So even though the paychecks that he's getting from the Saudi Golf League are incredibly large for him to go out and get players and organize this thing and put it on the map, I don't think that his principle goes that length. I don't think his principle in what he's trying to accomplish is only as long as the check is, right? I think in Greg Norman's case, it is a fundamental belief that he has that the way golf is played should be changed. We'll talk a little bit more about the NBA playoffs last night. Three big wins from the three teams, but what does it say about the teams on the losing end? We'll talk about that coming up next as we continue. On Twitter, at Tony D Radio, at Ron Culver, that's Ron with two N's. We'll get to a couple of your tweets as well. As we continue, it's Wake Up Call on Sports Map Radio. Glad you can be with us.
Wake Up Call with Tony D and Ron Culver continues now on the Sports Map Radio Network. Here's Tony D and Ron Culver.
All right, again on Twitter, at Tony D Radio, at Ron Culver. That's Ron with two N's. Robert on Twitter, I'm still pulling for Denver and Monte Morris from Flint, Michigan. A great story and dream come true. Monte Morris, the record-breaking Flint recruit, Michigan State, let's slip away. Yeah, okay, Robert. I have a soft spot in my heart for the Nuggets, too. I when I got to Denver in 2002, you know, I said, you know, I have to cover these teams. I like the people. They embraced me. I was a new person on the scene. I was getting to know the personnel. I was getting to know the PR people and the coaches and whatnot. And I started to really like the Nuggets. Now, this was the, going back to Michigan, the Juwan Howard Nuggets back in the day. They were awful. But remember when I talked about Juwan Howard when he was, you know, in that line and he punched that, you know, got in that altercation. I said, Juwan Howard was one of the nicest, one of the most pleasant athletes I covered in my time in Colorado. And so I was a little surprised by that reaction because he was the spokesperson for a really, really lousy team. Really lousy. And then they got Carmelo Anthony and started going to play. So I have a soft spot in my heart for Denver. But there is no question last night, they don't have any more ammunition. They don't. They have no more ammunition around Nikola Jokic to contend with Golden State. Now, I hope I'm wrong because I want to see Denver pull out a series here. I've been waiting for this Nuggets team that has gotten as far as mid-level in the Western Conference. They've had two good runs at the NBA Finals. Many, many years ago, they made a run against Kobe's Lakers with Carmelo Anthony. I want to say 2009, but I could have my dates wrong. They all get blurry as you get older. They made it to the Western Conference Finals, lost to the Lakers. Then a couple of years ago, they were in the Western Conference Finals against LeBron and the Lakers and lost. They've made two good runs. They've got one of the best players in the game. They got the MVP. They've got a guy that should win the MVP again. They just don't have people around him. Monte Morris is a absolutely good story, but that team that they're playing in Golden State is absolutely loaded. Absolutely loaded. So kind of feel a little bad for them. They caught the wrong team in the postseason. You kind of want to, you know, a team you can match up with pretty well and then see where it goes. Robert hit me up on Facebook about the USFL. I don't know if you just saw this. The USFL ratings were actually pretty good in some areas. The Michigan, Michigan Panthers? The team we joked about with Jeff Fisher? The Detroit, Michigan area, the USFL game got a 4.0. And that's not bad. But you gotta capitalize on. Robert on Twitter: I'm hoping for spring football, but I don't understand why they want to start so many teams and so many games right away. The teams should be in the South, especially Texas, where football is more popular. Start the spring season earlier, play 7 games in a playoff. Anyway, we'll see how it goes. Okay, correct me if I'm wrong, Ron. Didn't the XFL, the thing we liked 2 years ago, just before COVID, that started sometime in February, did it not?
I believe so.
Because it had a couple of games under its belt before it got shut down in March, like everything else in the world.
Yeah.
And then, unlike everything else in the world, it immediately went into bankruptcy mode. Like, yeah, we're done. Oh, but what do you mean? You mean done for, like, COVID? No, done forever. You're like, what? We were just starting to Dragons.
That was the weird one.
Yeah, that was the weird one.
I mean, AAF, I remember, they got 8 games in, and then they had to cancel their season, and then they left their players stranded, which was awesome.
That was, if I'm not mistaken, golly, I'm trying to remember all of these. Like I have to organize. I'm going to have to get a legal pad and organize all of these different leagues into, all these little different leagues into what was it about them that was unique or interesting. If I'm not mistaken, the AAFL, was that not either Don Allemeyer's son, or it was some executive, TV executive's son.
The AAFL. Isn't that
You know what? I hate doing research on the air and on the show.
No, I'm not. I'm refusing to, because we should know this off the top of our head. Who was the
longtime? I read an entire article.
Who was the longtime president of NBC Sports? Last name began with an E.
Oh, Dick Ebersol. Was this Dick Ebersol's kid?
I think
so. Ran this?
I think so.
Why was I thinking Don Allemeyer? He was Monday Night Football. I think this was Dick Ebersol's kid that was running this, and they had no money, and they didn't pay people, and they had different companies that they were doing business with, and they were bouncing checks, and it kind of was a mess. But I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think you're right. I think it was Charlie Ebersol.
I think it was Charlie.
Is that Charlie Ebersol? Please, my brain. I'm lucky I'm breathing. I'm telling you, my brain is filled with this kind of useless stuff. It's amazing. My brain is stuffed with so much useless trivia. It's amazing my brain has enough room to go, yeah, and we have to breathe, and we have to turn oxygen into energy and do all the other normal things that a human body does on a daily basis. All these things it does every second. We're lucky we're able to do all this from all the useless knowledge that you've crammed in your head. I'm going to tell you something, and I mean this at all. This is not a pat on my back bragging thing. I want to make this very clear. This is almost like it's kind of sad thing. If I went and gathered 50 of my friends from all over the place, from all different walks of life, all around the country that I've made, and I gathered them in a room, and I said, how many of you know the name of the person that was behind the start of the AAFL? And I gave them a hint that it was a son of a TV executive. Nobody would get it.
Yeah.
Nobody would get not one correct answer in the room of 50. That's not me bragging that I know useless trivia. It's me being sad that I know that kind of trivia. Seriously. You know, real quick, did I tell you the story about my wedding ring?
Real quick.
So I had surgery a year ago. And you know, they make you take off your jewelry.
Yeah.
So I had to take off my wedding ring. And I took off my wedding ring and I gave it to my wife before I went in for knee surgery. And a couple, as I was recovering and whatnot, then I started gaining weight, you know, because I wasn't able to move, and I was eating and I was laying on the couch while I was recovering. So when my wife gave me my wedding ring, it didn't quite fit very well. And I'm like, you know what? I gave it back to her and I said, keep this because, you know, I do plan to go back to walking and losing weight. When I do, I'll get the wedding ring back from you. So it had been like a year. And I said to her, hey, you know what? I never got that wedding ring back from you. And she goes, yeah, you did. I gave it back to you. You put it in your office. You couldn't put it on, so you put it in your desk drawer in your office. And I said, no, I didn't. I said, you have it. Check your thing. She looked all over. She couldn't find it. She checked everywhere. She goes, no, I gave it to you. I go, I know I didn't take it back. I gave it to you when I was having surgery. I've never taken it back. She goes, did you check your drawer? And I did the thing guys do, which is like open the drawer for a split second and go, nope, not in here. It's not here. So she started freaking out. She came into my office. She opened the drawer. In 3 seconds, she found the ring.
Of course she did.
3 seconds.
You know why?
She palmed it.
Yeah. Sleight of hand.
That's what I'm thinking.
She's a magician.
She put it in her hand. She covered it up. And then, oh, see, you had it this whole time.
See, while she was distracting you with what she had in her left hand.
Right, right, right.
She threw it down with her right hand, and you didn't even notice because you were focused on, oh, what is that in your left hand? I'm interested in that.
I'm interested in, exactly. So she accused me again of not remembering things, and she says, you're starting to lose it because you don't remember these things. And I said, I know you didn't give me that. So this is a perfect example of when my wife would say, you remember some guy named Charlie Ebersol starting a football league for half a season? And you didn't even remember that I gave you your ring? See, that's the world I live in. That's the world I live in. That I know that Bob Horner hit 4 home runs for the Atlanta Braves one game back in the 1980s. But you ask me where something important is, where my, I don't know, my tax form is for tax, I have no clue. I have no idea. That's the world I live in. It's awful. It's awful. All right, back to the Spring League. So real quick.
Which
the
one?
Ratings, okay, the USFL. Yeah, right. Which one? I'm telling you, I'm putting this chart together. I'm putting this alternative football league chart together and, to give you all the talking points for each league that's been created.
Before you give us these stats, in 10 to 15 years, will there be a AAFL reboot?
Right. Well, will there be?
Because we're on our second USFL. We're about to. We're going to get our third XFL.
Yep. Yeah, the third return of the XFL. The XFL that's coming next year is nothing to do with the one that just folded, and it has nothing to do by far with the one 20 years ago. Yeah. It's like you know what it is? It's like if you created I'm trying to think of something off my head, like top of my head, like a video game system, right? Like you created a video game system, it's like an Xbox, but it's your own thing. And you have a great name for it, right? And you launch it, and it doesn't catch on. But my God, that name is so good. You can't possibly. So somebody else buys it, and they go, we're going to redo it. We're going to create. We're going to add more memory to it. We're going to add more processing speed. We're going to create more games. We just love the name. And then they launch it. And it doesn't catch on. And then another group says, we're even going to make it better than that. We're going to make it virtual reality as well as playing this game. It's going to have the greatest video games of all time. You're going to think you're really in a video game because we love the name so much. That's the XFL. The XFL has such an attractive appeal to whoever is putting these things together. They can't give it away. Instead of it being poison, it's like, no, that's the only thing we want. We want that. That ball, that black football with the red spiral thing, no. We'll figure out it. But the XFL is the thing we want. It's an attractive name. It's better than AAFL, I'll tell you that right now. I didn't know what to call it. We were calling it AAFL. Now, that didn't work.
No, we still get it confused, too, because yeah. I forget the L. I call it AAF.
The AAF, right, yeah. I mean, sorry, Charlie Ebersol, but that didn't roll off the tongue like XFL did.
No.
And even USFL is pretty good, but had 40 years of
integration. There's history.
Right.
There's history there. We can say USFL, because first of all, we like US.
Right. We like U.S.
Who doesn't like U.S.?
So anything with the U.S. attached to it, we like.
Yeah.
And plus, every time, you know, we've had, even though the league was out, every time they would talk about Jim Kelly and Steve Young, they would always bring it up. They would always go, well, they played in the USFL. You remember that old league back in the day? Blah, blah, blah. And that's, you know, that's basically how it became sort of kind of common. But anyway, the ratings were good. Don't get me wrong. I want you to be careful here, though. The initial interest in something boosts ratings tremendously. It's, do you hang on to your audience? Do you keep it going? Do you get people more interested or less interested in what you're doing? I feel I'm nervous for the USFL because I don't think the football is particularly good. And I think when you lack a crowd, there's something unattractive about it. I think, I'm sorry, but it is hard for me to watch a major event when nobody's there. It was freaky to do it during COVID when we understood it. I don't like when I watch football games. I don't like those. I got to be honest with you. I don't even like those bowl games during the holidays where they're playing someplace and they pan like the Shreveport football stadium and there's nobody there.
Yeah.
I don't even like that. We're like, here at Sam Boyd Stadium for the Las Vegas Bowl between two teams that have absolutely nothing to do with the city of Las Vegas, and the temperatures are rising, and the feud will be on the field, and then they pan the crowd, and it's like, there's probably 2,000 people there. I don't even get pumped up for that. So how can I get pumped up for a league that's in Birmingham playing games in front of less than 1,000 people, one estimate said, for one game? I was like, they said they gave away 4,000 tickets and less than 1,000 were redeemed for a game. It's like crazy.
I believe those numbers, though.
Yeah, I do, too.
At
least they're being honest. All right, again, Ryan Ballingy is going to join us at 40 past the hour. We'll talk the legacy of Greg Norman with his 30 for 30 coming up tonight on ESPN. It's Tony D, Ron Culver, and Sports Map Radio.
This is Wake Up Call on the Sports Map Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
Three more games on your NBA playoff schedule tonight. Miami hosting Atlanta, Heat up 1-0. Minnesota up 1-0 over Memphis will play game 2 at FedEx Forum tonight. And then the Pelicans will try to even up their series against Chris Paul and the Phoenix Suns. Good luck. Those are the three games tonight. I think Atlanta's going to bounce back tonight. I think Atlanta's going to even that up with the Heat. That's my guess. Watch that be wrong. Because that's how I roll. I usually get these wrong. But I think Atlanta will bounce back. Atlanta's too good of a team to get swept or losing five. And they had a up and down season this year, but they got some talent on that team. Minnesota, man. If I'm Memphis, I got to be really careful. I told you last week I thought Memphis was ready for that breakout run towards the NBA Finals. Right? This is a team that doesn't get on national TV very, very often. I mean, people kind of know Ja Morant, but not a lot of people in the country get to see him on a regular basis outside of some highlights. The Grizzlies had this incredible enigma about them in which they were winning games by double digits, big double digits, without Ja Morant in the lineup, which made people go, how can Ja Morant be an MVP if the team is just fine without him? But he still is a dynamic player. And I was ready for this big push, which I still think is coming because I don't think Memphis is – I think this is sort of the wake-up call that happens with teams. They're like, whoops, all right, let that one slip away. But tonight, if they fall down 0-2 and both of those games at home, I said before, I've seen one or two teams be able to get back into a series in which they lose the first two games at home and win the series, but it doesn't happen very often. I was spoiled – I think as when I say spoiled, not necessarily in a good way. I was spoiled growing up because the Boston Garden was such a tough place to play. It had all these little intricacies about the parquet, the arena itself, the fact that there was no air conditioning. I mean, there's all these little things that made the Boston Garden a very difficult place to play. And then going out west to the Forum or going to the Spectrum in Philly or wherever, you know, those places were they really provided a home court advantage, too. So stealing games when I was young, if you could win a game at Philly or if you could win a game in Los Angeles or whatever, it was really like a big, big, big deal. You know, series obviously didn't hold home court, but to get a game in Los Angeles or whatever. And so I think Memphis gets a wake-up call, and you know, losing at home, opening game of the playoffs against a Minnesota team that was really emotional with their game, their play-in victory against the Clippers. Remember, they celebrated. They got criticized for celebrating. They're like, why are you celebrating? You just to get into the playoffs. And people in Minnesota said, you don't understand. It's a big deal. It may not be a big deal to you. You may not be able to feel the same thing, but it's a big deal to us. So, you know, let us celebrate because we're really excited about this team and what it can do. And then they carried that with them into their opening game over the weekend against Memphis, in which they really put it to the Grizzlies. They really, really beat them up pretty bad. And so Memphis is going to try to even up that series. And as I said earlier, I don't think New Orleans has the firepower capable of staying in a series with Phoenix. I think Phoenix wins this with ease. Those are the games tonight. But the team I was most impressed with yesterday, and I was impressed with all three winners. I mean, it really was. Philly, Dallas, Golden State. All three home teams yesterday. I thought Philly matched the physicality and accepted the physicality of what Toronto was going to do. They wanted to put Joel Embiid on the line. He made 12 of 14 free throws, accepted the physicality nature of the game. Doc Rivers said he was really proud of his team because he said, listen, they were not getting calls. They were getting hacked down there, and they were not getting calls, and they didn't complain. They went right back and played defense and waited for the next possession to see if they could do something. The Golden State Warriors, again, it's not the Splash Brothers. It's not the same kind of thing that we saw before. Obviously, no Kevin Durant, but they really are playing fluid basketball. That system rolls through that team really easily. Jordan Poole is a seamless addition to what they can do with Curry and Klay Thompson, and even Draymond Green. Aaron Wiggins is same kind of thing. I mean, Andrew Wiggins, same kind of thing. Dallas, though, I think was the most impressive to me. Because, again, without your star player, you absolutely need somebody to step up. And you can exchange the production of a Luka Doncic with, like, two or three players, right? You can go, well, Luka gives us this and this, and we can match that with this guy and this guy and this guy. But last night, Jalen Brunson was able to do the bulk of that. He was able to get the 41 points. He hit 6 3-pointers. Maxi Kleber hit 8. They finished with 22. It was a must-win game. I'm sorry. I know saying that a game two is a must-win is kind of silly, but it was a must-win game. They were not going to go to Salt Lake City. And again, if you're down 0-2 in a series, a seven-game series, you are then asked to win at least you got to win 4 out of the next 5 games. That's your task. And that is really difficult to do. This whole one game at a time thing, they all have to say it when they're down 0-2 because that's the only way you can look at it. Because if you look at it any larger than that, you're in deep trouble. Because if your mind expands to the idea of what's really at hand, you won't be able to do it. But if you go, all right, let's just win this game, see what happens after that. Then we win this game and see what happens after that. I don't think it's necessarily cliche. I think it's out of survival. Because when you think about a team that just beat you twice at home and you go, how are we going to do that 4 times? How are we going to match that? I think that's why you're seeing frustration in Denver. I think that's why you saw DeMarcus Cousins go at it on the bench with one of his teammates. I think that's why you saw Nikola Jokic get ejected when once again he felt like he deserved a call and didn't get it. It was just frustration. These players know when they don't have it. They know when their team is not capable. And I think the Nuggets are at that point where they know their best is not close enough to beating Golden State. And it's deflating. And then when you think larger picture after being down 0-2 and you say to yourself, oh, God, how are we going to win 4 out of the next 5 against this team that feels like they're doing it with a hand tied behind their back? That becomes a problem. So you do have to take it sort of one game at a time. So for Dallas, it was a must win. I think they had to even up that series at home. All right, they got a split. Fine. We can survive the split. We can't survive 0-2 losing both games at home and having to go to Salt Lake City. And for Jalen Brunson and Maxi Kleber to take over that game, to hit the kind of shots that they were hitting, especially Kleber, he was great. He was hitting threes from all around the perimeter. Then they, without Luka Doncic and who should be available at some point in the series, that was my most impressive team of the night last night. All right. Greg Norman had a stellar career. He's still in the news. What about his legacy next? With Ryan Ballingy as we continue on Sports Map Radio.
You're listening to to Wake Up Call on the SportsMap Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, so tonight the Shark 30 for 30 is going to appear. And listen, you know, it's one thing to have a documentary where you're talking about something in the, you know, in the past, reliving a memory. But there's also the subject is in the news, and that's Greg Norman. They're going to focus a lot on his collapse at the 96 Masters and his career. But he's also in the news again with the Saudi Golf League and promoting that. Ryan Ballinger joining us from Golf News Net. We love having him on the show to talk all things golf. How are you, my friend?
Good, Tony. How are you?
All right, so let's get into, before we get into some of the specifics of his collapse in 96 and the Saudi Golf League, let's talk about the kind of career Greg Norman had. It was early 80s, and then in the 1980s, he was a dominant figure. How would you best describe his presence in golf?
I feel like he had a lot of unfilled potential. I mean, he got there so many times. And like you said, he was a dominating figure. I mean, he was number one in the official world golf ranking, which at that time had only been around, you know, about a decade, but still was the dominating player of the first age of the official world golf ranking. And yet he never really seemed to win enough, and he never really seemed to win in big spots. I mean, you think about the Saturday Slam in 1986, where he had at least a share of the 54-hole lead in all four majors that year. And you'd think that would have led to the most incredible season of his life, and it was, but it didn't turn out the way that maybe you might have expected with the four 54-hole leads. And then, like we talked about, the 96 Masters, it just feels like a lot of posts in his career of, man, what could have been.
He was one of the more sympathetic athletes in the 80s because not only would he lose, he would lose in dramatic fashion. Bob Tway's bunker shot at Inverness, Larry Mize's chip in, even a tournament like the Nestle Invitational at Bay Hill where Robert Gomez drained one out from with a 7-iron the 18th hole, like the 72nd hole. Like, he was a guy that, you know, you talk about shark, he was shark bit. How did that permeate the way he was playing? Like, how did you marry the two from this dominating presence, this large, tall, could hit it a mile golfer with this idea that guys just found ways to beat him?
Yeah, and it just seemed like defeat found its way to Greg Norman, whether that was through someone else's miracle, like you mentioned all of those guys, or just kind of self-imposed nerves or meltdowns or mistakes. But then he would have these moments like at the Players Championship where Fuzzy Zeller comes out, waves the white flag, towels him down. He's killing the field by a million. And it's this juxtaposition of sometimes he did what he was supposed to do, at least given his ranking and how he was perceived by the public, and destroyed fields. This was the dominating golfer that would be a number one player in the world. But in certain spots, in certain situations, not only did he find a way to lose or someone found a way to beat him, but he was also pretty gracious about it. I mean, I think he was probably much more gracious in public than he probably was in private about it all. But he was a figure people could get behind because even when he lost, he still projected that kind of confidence along with grace that came with just the nature of this sport and being the supposed best player of the era in the sport.
I think this documentary tonight is rather an interesting placement on the calendar because if it was just reliving a collapse of something 20-plus years ago, we'd probably go, oh, that was kind of cool, maybe I'll watch it. But Norman is still in the news, and majorly so with this Saudi Golf League. And I was talking about this earlier. A lot of people's sentimentality goes, you know, or cause or belief goes really the length of a coin, right? If they're getting paid to promote something, they tend to really, really be into it. And when they're not, they don't care. But Norman is a little different. You and I talked about this one other time. He's always tried to find a way to do something else besides the PGA Tour. Is his recent involvement in this an outlier of what he tried to do years ago, or is this something different?
I think this is a continuation of a 30-year grudge against Tim Fincham, the prior commissioner of the PGA Tour, because he tried to come up with this notion of a world tour, and he projected that he kind of had it. He had the deal done, and he was going to have the players behind him, and then mean old Tim Fincham came in and ruined it all and co-opted it and created the World Golf Championships, which, I mean, they're basically dead now. They weren't that big of a deal at the end of the day. And with this opportunity, as he perceives it, with Saudi investment, their public investment fund, to create this concept called Live Golf, L-I-V, all in capital letters, assume Roman numerals 54. This concept that he can go stick it to the tour and say, oh, I've created this idea of monster-sized purses with no control from a supposed governing body that doesn't really pay enough to the players. I'm going to stick it to them while at the same time still trying to maintain what you've talked about, being a successful businessman outside of golf with whatever ventures he's done between clothing and wine and other investments and partnerships with Verizon and stuff like that. It's a really interesting thing that this guy is probably worth $500 million to himself, but still is trying to operate under this grudge that has really bothered him for 3 decades and is still trying to exact some degree of revenge on the PGA Tour.
If Phil Mickelson has to go in pretty much hiding for his comments, how does Greg Norman, with all of his business ventures and all of the intertwined nature of what he does, how is he surviving this controversy?
That's really an interesting part of this. I think because he hasn't agreed to play anything. And so he hasn't said anything also quite as headline-grabbing, perhaps, as what Mickelson said to Alan Shipnick and John Huggin in bashing the PGA Tour and, in, frankly, bashing the Saudi benefactors behind this breakaway tour. Norman has been very adept politically, even if some of the stuff he says makes you cringe. It's very neutral. It's not designed to be provocative or offensive. It's designed to project bravado and confidence, which he kind of has to do right now, given where this concept is. But I don't think he's ever said anything so offensive about the Saudi benefactors one way or the other that he's really been thrown into the same mix as Mickelson.
He made a point, which I found really interesting, and I guess I'm just going to try to narrow it down. He was saying, look, I'm going to have this event, and I'm going to fill it with people, and they may not be the best golfers in the world, but when the best golfers in the world look at the money that I'm giving to these golfers, and they know they can beat them, they'll join. Is there any validity to that? That made me go, well, that's an interesting strategy. I don't know if it'll work, but that's certainly an interesting strategy.
Yeah, that's kind of where I came down on it. Was, on one hand, you are belittling the players that are rumored to be coming into your midst. They're going to sign on the dotted line, right? And we've heard all kinds of different players rumored to have joined, but none have officially announced that they have. But if you're any of those players that have signed the dotted line or are strongly considering it, and Norman says, well, I'm going to put on these events so these guys can win money, and then the better players are going to come and beat the snot out of them. How do you feel? Do you feel like you're just a pawn in a long-term game to try to get to John Rahm and Colin Morikawa and Victor Hovland, those kinds of guys? But at the same time, do you feel also validated in the idea that maybe you can kind of still stick it to the tour, that you can still say, hey, I can get all this money, I can do it in one fell swoop, and probably at the end of the day, if you're one of those players in their 40s that have kind of been rumored to sign with this, does anyone really care if you take that Saudi money, if you go win a couple $4 million purse event or $25 million purse events to get $4 million for first, beating a bunch of never beens and never wases? I mean, maybe not. Maybe that's the calculation. But I think Norman's proposition that he's going to put on these events regardless and then eventually attract the best talent because they're just going to jaw drop at who wins $4 million and is going to make them jealous, it's an interesting idea. But then again, you have so many of these players, top 20 players, players under 30, have all committed to the PGA Tour publicly and said, look, I'm staying on this tour. I don't care what money you offer. And that leads me to believe that all the reporting around what the PGA Tour plans to do next with a team series kind of its own is already starting to move forward, maybe more than Norman thinks it has.
All right, let's get to the collapse of 96, because this was a guy that came so close to a green jacket. Jack Nicklaus beat him in 86, and then Larry Mize, the chip in on 11, the year later. He's come so close. He's played well enough there. But back in 96, he really owned the first 3 days of the tournament. And you can even say he owned the first 3.5 days, because everyone was waiting for him to get to the first tee and just have a coronation walk with a six-shot lead. As a golfer, as somebody who studies this game, is there a way you can pinpoint what was starting to go wrong for Greg Norman during that final round and how Nick Faldo, his playing partner, just went, fine, I'll take it?
I think it was a combination of things. I think we didn't pay enough attention to what Faldo was kind of doing in the front nine, just trying to chip away. He knew he had a mountain to climb, and he probably presumed, just like the rest of us, it was going to be impossible to do, given a six-shot lead. but then he was just chipping away. He was playing good golf, Valdo was, on Sunday. And leads are tenuous things, even big leads, because you just need one domino to fall for it to all to fall apart. I mean, think about subsequent Masters meltdowns in the years since. Think about Rory McIlroy in 2010. Think about Jordan Spieth in 2016. Jordan Spieth was up 7 shots with 8 holes to play and lost the golf tournament. So it just takes, particularly on that golf course, Augusta National, it just takes one or two mistakes, and they pile up, and you think, okay, especially early in the round, because then you think, well, I've got to get through 10 and 11 and 12, and then I've got to get through 18. I've got to get through all these holes. We think about all the birdie holes. We think about 13 and, to a degree, 14, 15, certainly 16. We think about the birdie eagle holes because that's what makes the Masters exciting. But the players think about the scary holes because they're the ones they got to get through. And I think that started to pile up for Norman, and all of a sudden he started to press and think, I've choked so many times before. I'm not letting this one get away. Here comes Faldo. And all those things get in your head, and you think, okay, your brain's not going to function normally. You're not going to think properly. You're not going to move at the same speed you moved at for 3 days so confidently, and everything starts to be doubted. And I think that's what happened to Norman. I think Faldo was particularly understanding of that. I'm sure he's been through that in his career with the swing changes he made with David Ledbetter and all that stuff. So it was kind of a sympathy situation there where, I'm going to win this green jacket from you, Greg, but I completely understand why this happened.
Do you think Greg Norman, and again, this will be just speculation, do you think he's a different man the way he does business or the way he aligns himself with different things if he had won the Masters? If he was part of that group every single April, hung out with that champions dinner every single April, do you think he'd be a different person today?
What a what-if universe that would have been, huh?
No kidding.
I mean, would he have won another major championship beyond that? Would he have won another Masters? You never know what that win could have spurred him onto. And then he's about to run into, in 96, Tiger the next year. Does Tiger win the Masters by 12? There's a huge what-if there, a huge butterfly effect of being the number one player in the world and the reigning Masters champion. Do those things change? There's a lot, I think, that would have changed in golf had Norman pulled it through, whether it was by one in a playoff, by 10, it doesn't matter. If he got the green jacket, I think his life would have been dramatically different. But I think he kind of also saw the writing on the wall to a degree. I mean, he had been one of the most important players of the mid-'80s, basically from Jack's last Masters to this point. And then here comes Tiger and takes it all away, I think, and kind of shoved him to the background to a degree. So I think, yeah, probably would have been a little bit different, especially for Tiger, but I don't know if it would have been so dramatically different that he still wouldn't have done the things he's ultimately gone on and done, because I think he's always had an eye for business. He's always had an eye for trying to make money and trying to kind of live the billionaire or huge millionaire's lifestyle, and he's done that. And I also think we may not have gotten 2007 in the Open Championship, which I think is a really underrated accomplishment in his career. What, 54 years old, with dating Chrissy Everett, just kind of got in the tournament on a whim and almost won the thing. I mean, the final round was crazy at Carnoustie, but that he almost did it. That was a stunning thing to me. But at the end of the day, I think it probably would have been a little bit different, but not dramatically different, knowing who Greg Norman is.
Final question. I got about 60 seconds, but I did want to end on this. Given everything, I mean, all of the things, all the business ventures, some of the controversy, but the way he played, the way he influenced the golfers, put it all together, is he a beloved golf figure? When people think of him and hear him, do they have the same reverence for him as we do other past champions?
I don't think so. I mean, and I don't mean that as a slight on Norman or his talent or what he did or didn't accomplish inside the ropes. I just think he was kind of a bridge figure in a strange way. And like I said, he was a contender in the 86 Masters and had the Saturday Slam that year. But beyond that, I mean, he had a whole bunch of bad stuff happen to him in majors, but never really cashed in. So I think people think of the major tally. They think, how many did you get? And he got 2. Yeah. Well, Spieth's got 3. So, I mean, if you're going to put in the pantheon, you know, those simple terms, okay, he wasn't that successful, but he won so many times around the world. He won, I mean, he was a dominating figure, the number one in the world golf ranking. So I don't think people appreciate what he accomplished to the same degree that maybe people who watch a sport as intently would. And I think that's just because he got caught between the end of Jack, however glorious that was, and the beginning of Tiger, as amazing as that was.
Amazing. Ryan, always good having you on the show. Again, the documentary will be tonight. Really appreciate your insight into Greg Norman. Thanks a lot, my friend.
Thanks, Tony. Appreciate it.
You got a Ryan Ballinger, Golf News Net. If you love golf and want to get know more about it, he's got a great, great site, Golf News Net. Ryan Ballinger, frequent guest on the show. And again, tonight, Shark, the documentary on Greg Norman. As we continue with Wake Up Call.
Astro, no.
This is Wake Up Call on the Sports Map Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, Ryan Ballinger, thanks to him for joining us. Talk a little Greg Norman. Greg Norman was my favorite player golfer when I was a kid because he looked cool.
Yeah, and he had the accent.
Hair and the accent.
The hat.
Yeah, like he looked like he was in the band Dire Straits.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or
well, he seemed like
Vegemite.
He seemed like a rebel on the tour.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, because he had that, like, he didn't wear like a visor or anything. He had like that flowing blonde hair, and he was tall, and he was one of the best drivers of the golf ball. He was magnificent at driving the golf ball. He could hit it hard and far. With those persimmon woods back in the day. It's magnificent, fantastic. All right, so thanks to Ryan Ballinger again. We'll be back tomorrow with more NBA playoff talk. These round one games aren't bad. All right, we'll continue along at. Sports Map Radio continuing along, so we will see you tomorrow. It's Tony D, Ron Culver at Sports Map Radio. Have a good day.